Today's program was brought to you by Brooklyn Slate, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today you're listening to Chef's Story. We're broadcasting from beautiful Roberta's in cold Brooklyn.
Brooklyn's not cold.
I know. Okay, here's my Brooklyn buddy. I am so excited today. We've known each other a long time, and we're both from Brooklyn, so you're going to all have to, this is the Brooklyn Day on Chef's Story. But Michael Amonico, my guest today, is probably one of the most respected chefs in New York City, if not the whole country. Michael has a stellar past, which we're going to get into, but he's worked at such extraordinary restaurants as Le Cirque, 21 Club, and I think many people know he was the executive chef at Windows on the World on 9/11. But we're going to get into Michael's story. He has books. He's had TV shows. He's actually a trained actor. But the most important thing is he's one of the greatest Brooklyn guys I know. So welcome, Michael.
We love Brooklyn.
We love Brooklyn.
It's
here
so,
we are.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here. You know, it is really a trip to come out to Bushwick. You know, this is very exciting for me because I'm so happy to see this rebirth of Brooklyn. Brooklyn is such a thriving part of New York.
Right. You and I remember this as the UPS lot and the school bus lots. I mean, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for those of you who aren't here, which is the epicenter of the new restaurants in the world, you know, Bonkas and Roberta's here.
Yeah.
And lots of exciting young restaurants.
You go to Paris and they're talking about Le Brooklyn.
Le Brooklyn.
Le Williamsburg. No kidding.
Yeah,
but it's exciting. You know, I think that this constant revitalization is for anything is vital.
Yeah. So Michael, tell us about the Brooklyn you were born into and what it was like when you were born. And was it?
No.
Le Brooklyn back then.
No, but you know what? Brooklyn has always been... it has been for 200 years an exciting place for people to live. I mean, it was a vital part of New York City's growth and development. And, of course, we all know that Brooklyn was a city until it was incorporated into the greater New York City. It was its own separate city, right?
So, and it was probably a bad thing.
And Brooklynites are proud. Yeah.
Right.
Brooklynites are proud of being the fourth largest city
in America.
In America. And they've always had that. I mean, that is, I think, historically, that's there's truth to that. I grew up in Italian-American Bensonhurst, and, you know, that was a vital working-class neighborhood, still is,
mm-hmm.
And I heard stories of, Dodgers, the players living in Brooklyn mm-hmm. and being people's neighbors, and, you know, but the Dodgers when I was really 3 years old, they moved out of Brooklyn. So I heard Dodgers stories about how it was terrible. One time I was cooking for the O'Malleys, and I got a chance to tell them how they broke my father's heart. And after that, we became Yankees fans. Although that's that with an old Dodgers fan, you'd never have that. Really, a lot of the Dodger fans became Mets fans.
That's right. They would never,
never
go for
become
the Yankees
Yankee fans.
Fans
but
right.
that's another long story.
Right.
Look, Brooklyn, I love Brooklyn and lived here for the better part of my life. And It has soul.
Manhattan has commerce.
I have to
we
say,
have soul out here.
I mean, I have to be up front. I'm a Manhattanite now because it's just closer to work
mm-hmm.
and it's less stress. I spend more time in the kitchen than at work,
mm-hmm.
so it's important for me to kind of be close. But I make regular field trips, not only to Bushwick, to come out to Williamsburg to hit the these restaurants and galleries, and what a great vital neighborhood this is, but also to go out to, you know, Coney Island, and I go out to, exactly, Randazzo's, or to go out to you know, to Tono's Pizzeria. Yeah. I'm hoping, you know, I got my fingers crossed for those guys. And
Hurricane Sandy did a number
on
them.
Right. Yeah. And so you know, I still have a lot of roots in Brooklyn.
Well, let's talk about that, because you know what, Manhattan might have the restaurants, but Brooklyn really had the food. I mean,
we thought we did. We've always thought we did.
You know, we didn't have so many restaurants. People really cooked at home. But you think of the bakeries, you know, not only the bagels that you could get, but the salt sticks and the Kaiser rolls. Do you remember?
Well, I'm glad. You know, listen, I'll be brief. But I grew
Don't be
up.
Brief.
I grew up with that. You see, I grew up with not supermarkets, but everything was from artisanal supply.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. Right. Are you ready? We made our own dried sausage every winter. That was an October thing. We made our own wine. That was really something my family did for decades, right? And they were phasing it out as I was growing up in the
60s. Where did they get the grapes back then?
Grapes were from California. Grapes were from California, made wine, and we made dried sausage. You call it cacciatorini.
What age were you drinking wine from the family
Are you allowed
cast?
To say? Are you
yes,
allowed to
yes,
say?
Yes.
Now it would be abuse, right?
Wait, this is called Chef's Story. We're getting into your story.
Well, you
we
know,
want the
they,
real story,
they always
Michael.
Get, they go, if when you hit 7 years old, you got a taste of wine in your soda on a Sunday. A taste, you know? Because wine was on the table. It was a food. It wasn't...
Right.
It wasn't... really something that was viewed as more than that. It was really, and if you go to Italy today, I have cousins in Sicily, and I've been with them and been to Sicily. When they drink wine, they don't overdrink. Really, they don't drink much. It's part of a meal is a glass of wine, not much more than that. Right. So that's how I grew up. It was just part of a meal, and you got to taste it, but you didn't really, you know, get a glass.
So what was your favorite dish? On a Sunday. So Sunday, did you call it sauce or gravy?
No, it's gravy.
It's gravy.
It's gravy.
This is Brooklyn. You
it's gravy.
It gravy.
It's gravy.
All right,
it's
tell
gravy.
Us about the Sundays.
Well, it's gravy because it's sugo, you know, because it has all of these other things. It's not just tomato sauce. It's tomato. It's gravy because it has pork and beef and, you know, there was beef brujol.
What is sugo?
Well, sugo, in Italy, you'll find a sugo will be a gravy, really, that goes over a pasta.
Oh.
Might be a pork sugo or a lamb or, you know, and so S-U-G-O, sugo.
Okay.
And so that was really the gravy. Well, that's what we grew up with. But we made sausage, but we also bought eggs that only came from farms in New Jersey that were candled. We only, right?
What do you mean candled?
Candled. We bought eggs never in a supermarket. We bought our eggs from someone who brought them from New Jersey to a little storefront, and each one he held up in front of a candle to see if it was a good egg or a bad egg.
And tell us about a good egg and a bad egg.
Well,
a bad egg had a chicken in
it? Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Or it had blood, and you know. So we bought eggs from the egg man. We bought fish from the fish man that, you know, that was
what
fresh.
What kind of fish? From Sheepshead Bay? Would the fish man come from, or
well,
Montauk,
you know,
or where?
You know, from the Fulton Market, in the 60s, there were probably still some boats that were bringing local fish that were close enough to come into, you know, it wasn't all fish that was trucked from other places. There is local fish today. You can you can go to Sheepshead Bay and find some local fish. You can go out to Montauk and get lots of local fish. We know that. But but the fish man, the fish butcher, the fishmonger was like the... There was the butcher. You went to the butcher for meat, and it was all sides of beef or, you know, animal carcasses that were broken down. So I grew up seeing that. You know, that was something that was really part of, you know, my food. My mother taught me more about food than anything I've ever learned since was from ingredients. You know, I remember so clearly the first thing I learned to do was cook cranberry beans, you know? Cleaning the beans out of the shells and then cooking them with my mother. And she taught me how to make zeppoli, and she taught me how to clean calamari. I mean, I was the youngest of the three brothers. I was the youngest. My other two brothers were really older, much older. They were off to high school already when I was born. So my mother, you know, I was in the kitchen with her. She showed me all of these things that I remember to this day. So those Italian American dishes, those. But also
Did they
Sicilian.
Have vegetables trucks coming down?
Vegetable
your street?
Trucks down the street.
So you didn't even to go because
especially in season, because that was all Long Island,
right?
And you know that was Long Island and New Jersey vegetables. You know, you
And they would bring them in a truck on the back of a truck.
On the back, forget the green market; they came to your street,
right?
And it was there were trucks full of local vegetables. Yeah, and in the fall there was fruit that were on those trucks too, all the local apples. And you know, so I really have this. This is how food is in my head. You know, from the butcher, the fishmonger, you know, the egg man, all of these things. And it was all.
And they didn't have it in Manhattan, did they?
No. This was a village, right? I mean, right. It was Bensonhurst, but it was like you were shopping in a village, and everything was specialized. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd go to one butcher because he was better at beef, and another butcher because he was. You go to the pork store for pork.
Just pork.
Yeah.
The butcher was just pork.
Chicken markets. We only bought live chicken, right?
Live chicken.
I mean, it sounds like we're talking about another century. Well, it is another century, right? But this is mid-century Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, we bought, and you know what? There were live poultry markets. There are more live poultry markets today in New York City, today than there were 30 years ago.
Really?
Because they had really died out. You know, they'd really passed the live poultry markets. But in the 60s, when I was a kid in school, poultry markets were kind of everywhere in the Italian-American neighborhoods.
Okay, chef. Now I need some chef education here. Why is live poultry better than maybe getting a D'Artagnan? Or I'm not saying it's better than
but
you have some that are beautifully raised and slaughtered and brought in. Is it better chill them and age them, or is it better to have a super fresh pluck them yourself chicken?
Well, there's a couple of real reasons, and one is really just the quality of the bird itself. In the poultry markets are a better quality bird, and you can buy one that's more sustainably grown today. Uh-huh. In that day, in the 60s, you know, they were sustainably grown chickens because they were from Jersey. They weren't even from Maryland, you know. They were really from upstate New York. They were a very local chicken, and the live market meant that they were as super fresh as you want poultry to be. You want poultry to be as fresh as possible.
Right.
So, you know, it's the unfortunate cycle of life of a chicken, but you know, they were great chickens that were locally grown, and you know, that passed away. That became, you know, really processed chickens became the thing that you saw in supermarkets.
So do you think the produce,
but they taste different.
So what inspired you to be a chef? Was it the produce, or was it working with your mother? Because did you go to a lot of restaurants when you were a kid?
So we went to no restaurants.
Exactly.
What
restaurant?
I have to say, Chinese food. No, really. That was exotic.
Bensonhurst is like the biggest, it's like another state of Italy. And
but we grew up, you know, we were Italian-Americans, and we were Jewish Americans side by side. That's really right. That was the diversity then. It's different today, which is what makes, you know,
Brooklyn is.
But I lived in Brooklyn in the 70s when the Caribbeans were moving in and would drive out to, you know, go out to Church Avenue. Right. To go find jerk chicken. I was, you know, go looking for those things when I was, you know.
So in Bensonhurst, they had a good Chinese restaurant?
But there were, you know, those Chinese American restaurants were like, you know, probably what you would expect pre-Nixon, right? Because pre-Nixon's trip to China, it was Chinese, all over America. But on the other hand, you know, I also knew a little bit about Chinatown because my grandmother lived in Little Italy, and we had a lot of roots in Little Italy. So we got to
walk across this canal street.
We were there a lot when I was young. Uh-huh. You know, the Chinese markets were next to the Italian markets, one street different, that kind of thing. But Italian Americans in those days, there wasn't a lot of money for restaurants. Restaurants were a special thing, but
Chinese food. So did you have a special?
Exotic. It was special and exotic. Yes, that was. But also, you know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she really did all the cooking. We didn't get out that much. I mean,
so where was the tipping point for you to be a chef? On what cuisine? Chinese cuisine?
I think you know, it's interesting. I'll tell you, because I think here's the snapshot.
Go ahead.
So there I go. I go to college and I'm a theater major, and I eventually get out into the world, you know, and I start to explore this city, New York City, and start to really develop an interest in food. In the 70s, I think there was a whole new generation of people who were, you know, that generation was exploring food in a new way. And I think New York always offered so much diversity in its culinary history that, you know, as a young guy, I was exploring. And I was I traveled as an actor through the better part of this country, and I spent a lot of time in a year and a half of traveling. So I saw a lot of American cooking, real American cooking.
Wow.
And I mean to say New Orleans in 1976 and in the southern states in 1975. And that mid part of the 70s, we were coming on the bicentennial. Mm-hmm. So Americana was a big deal. And James Beard's writing in relation to that was a big deal. And so I began to read and explore and eat. And before you know it, I quit acting, went back to school, New York City College of Technology, to enter the restaurant hospitality management program. So it was American food that drove me into it. But my hobby as a chef was cooking Chinese food because of going to the markets in Chinatown, buying ingredients, and from a couple of really good books, you know, trying at home to make noodles, to make dumplings, to make Peking duck. And so it was a very cathartic thing for me to cook. And when I came to this tipping point where I thought, gee, I love cooking so much, I'm going to explore this. Going back to school was an important part of that process for me because I really needed to retool.
So we're gonna take a little break here, and when we come back, we're gonna explore what you did going to school and after. Today, I'm talking to Michael LaMonaco, the executive chef of Porterhouse in New York City, at the Time Warner Building. We'll be right back.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Executive Chef Michael LaMonaco from the restaurant Porterhouse in the Time Warner Building. And later on in the program, we'll hear more about that. But Michael, we were just talking about how you jumped from your Italian roots to loving Chinese food, and then being an actor and traveling around and discovering American. And you just started New York City Technical College. Tell us what that was like. What year you were back there in the early 80s?
83.
So what drove you? At that stage, what kind of chef did you want to be, and where did you think you'd end up?
Well, you know, there were not a lot of choices for schools and for training. And on the job training is great, but it's not the full immersion that you can get in an academic setting. or it can be not the full immersion. It really depends on the individual place. So I really had a time frame. I wanted to get going with this change, and City University has had this program that at City Technical College in Brooklyn, right?
Yes.
That's after a post World War II. Really, for the Korean vets returning, the program really ramped up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and like the Culinary Institute of America, that also started with the
right after World War II.
Right. Exactly. So, this retraining, this idea of trade schools and training mm-hmm. people in a setting like that, it was a good one for me, and mm-hmm. it was also at that time a very French classical system oriented,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to like this because I love French cooking, French culture,
mm-hmm.
since my grade school days of junior high school French. I took junior high school French. I took high school French. I took college
really?
French. It's true. So I had this real passion for the...
Had you had any French food?
No, not really. Very, very limited. Duck au orange, you know, very limited. But then, you know what? I did have exposure to it. As I, in my 20s, then going out to some of the great French bistros
mm-hmm.
that have thrived in Manhattan mm-hmm. near the West Side. And there were mm-hmm. some great bistros that were really immigrant-run bistros mm-hmm. that had authentic bistro cooking. And as a 20-year-old, that was someplace that I was going. So I mm-hmm. had this in my, and, you know, I loved French food, and this is what they taught. But it was really about the system. And I thought that I identified with systematic way of learning something,
mm-hmm.
The way I had learned acting. There mm-hmm. was something systematic.
The method.
Not only that, the method,
yes.
but also, you know, what they do in college. I went to a Brooklyn college where I graduated from Brooklyn College with a degree in speech and theater. And that was a very, you know, it was something very methodical about how you are taught acting and you're taught drama. You know, from the experimental Grotowski to Shakespeare, you know, and everything in between, in that setting, I know I can learn, you know. And that's...
Great analogy.
And I thought, I can identify with this system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I got at City Tech. I got a real system of learning, and mm-hmm. I really feel what it did was it gave me a really well-rounded skill set
mm-hmm.
that what I would do with it, I didn't know.
So when you came out, did you say, I want to own my own restaurant, I want to go work in one of the temples of astronomy?
You know, all through school, I worked at Monty's Venetian Room on the Gowanus Canal. I love
the shrimp scampi there.
I worked at Monty's. It's still there. Monty's is still there.
Oh, is it still open?
Well, yeah, there's some, you know, Nick Monty is gone now, but mm-hmm. Nick Monty was my mentor and hired me as, you know, a prep cook.
Mm-hmm.
Then I worked in the garde-manger. Then I worked on the broiler station. Then I worked on sauté. And I was going to school in the day and working at night. And I learned how to cook Italian-American, you know, that classic
all right, we're
red
all
sauce.
Going to the Porterhouse
Porterhouse,
soon,
New York.
And you're going to make me shrimp scampi.
Well, I can do it. I can do it.
I'm going to order it
Escalon,
if you love me.
Escalon, I can do it. And I love to cook Italian. It's what I do at home is cook Italian food and not just the Italian-American favorites, but also the Sicilian things that my mother made. And, you know, it's really part of me is
right.
Italian.
So tell me about your career path, because I know we have a lot of people out there that love to follow how right. a great chef becomes a great chef.
But I, you know, so it was all about skill development for a year and a half, both days and nights. It was all about how do I develop my skills.
So while you're in school, you're working at Monty's.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Upon graduation, I worked at a private club, which was a kind of a fancy midtown luncheon and dinner club, private.
You mean like the university club?
Right, exactly.
Like
I worked at a private club. You know, I got a call and Alain Sayac was mm-hmm. the chef at Le Cirque. And that was the turning point. And I did want to work at Le Cirque. I really wanted to work mm-hmm. in what was, in its day, the epitome of dining in New York. And certainly one of the great world destinations mm-hmm. for dining was Le Cirque in the mid-'80s. And Alain hired me, you know, as a starting cook. And, you know, I worked with Alain and I worked with Danielle Belou. Because Alain left a year later, and then I worked with Danielle for about 9 months. And I followed Alain to the 21 Club, and mm-hmm. I was a daytime saucier slash sous chef. Mm-hmm. So 4 years after graduating in 1989, I had come and gone from the 21 Club. But 4 years after graduating from school, I was rehired back at 21 as the executive chef.
Four and a half years later?
So, yeah. So,
wow.
In 1989, I became, you know, that was...
I know. You had such good acting ability. You were acting like Paul Bocuse or something.
You know what? You could... And I have to say, it's only a short time ago. That was 24 years ago. It really doesn't seem like...
24 years.
I know. It doesn't seem that long to me. But I'll tell you, at that time, you know, chefs were always in the kitchen. Chefs only worked in one place. Uh-huh. Chefs really didn't own restaurants. It's really been an unbelievable ride to see how the American culinary scene and the American chefs, how they've kind of transformed the industry, not only for Americans, but I think worldwide, have really had an effect.
Absolutely.
That's the LeBrooklyn effect, really, on the world.
That's it, really. So take us, so you were at Le Cirque. What did the working in a place like that give you? You worked there for how long? 3 years?
I worked there for a year and a half. I'll tell you, I saw everything there. Now, we worked 6 days a week, and you either worked lunch or dinner. I worked both at different times. I'd worked both both shifts. Everything was, you know, made in house, right? So we butchered animals. We had a butcher there who we had a baby lamb. The you know suckling pig came in. We did all the we learned the fish butchery. And you had to set your station up, but whatever, if I worked on the grill station or I worked on the fish station or the veg station, you did everything from scratch. So, again, it came down
to... And you did volume.
And you
too.
Did volume. Le Cirque was a very, very busy restaurant, and it was a hot restaurant, you know. Mm. It was different dining than it is today, and it was a different dining scene, but it was as relevant then as anything would be today, and it was a great... It was a great place to learn.
Actually, it was more relevant. There were only one or two restaurants that really had the whole world, the paparazzi or the celebrities of the world pass through, and that was one of them.
You're right.
And today, there's probably 10 restaurants that they go to or 20.
You're right. It is very, very – food has become entertainment. And, you know, I think that that was clear that people would – You know, not buy a ticket to a show today. They don't buy a ticket to a show. They go to a, you know, they go to a bar or a restaurant, and that's the show.
So you were at Le Cirque, and then Danielle came, and then you went to 21.
And Danielle changed the whole menu. We did a whole new menu with Danielle. So that was, again, it was all about skill set and how much can you do. And to this day, I'm very close to Alain Sayac and very close to Danielle. And they were really my true mentors. And the French... you know, that they're as American as I am, you know, Danielle and Alain. But their training, you know, that's what a mentor is. A mentor takes what they've learned and pass it on. And Danielle and Alain both passed on skills to me. Danielle, Alain for his great organization and his precise manner of work and his the way he ran a kitchen. And Danielle also had a similar set of skills in organization and management. But also Danielle had come from a different part of France. So he brought from Lyon this real farm-to-table idea. And that was, you know, 1987.
Tell me something, because we have a lot of young cooks and chefs out there listening to the program. How important is it to go to a really great kitchen? How long should you stay there? What is it that you should take from the you're saying from the mentorship?
I think the most I think the most valuable time you have is those years where you're learning, and you I think that skill acquisition, the toolkit is the probably one of the most important things you could do for yourself for later development, and that at some point you'll have an opportunity to be creative in your own personal way. But in early part of the career, I think it's not about my, I think it's not about the cook's creativity. And I was a cook. It wasn't about my creativity. It was about my ability to perform the creation of the chef. You know, in other words, each restaurant has its own symphony, and you're not only in the orchestra, you're playing it. And part of the creative process is the is that recreation every night of what that chef's menu is. And if that becomes consistency, that's part of the skill development, and you get to a point where in order to be free as a creative person, you have to really know your instrument. The old French used to call the stove, they used to call it the piano. That's what they called it. And so I came from that school where, you know, you learn to play the piano. So no.
How long does that take?
I think it depends on the individual. But is it 2 years, three? I can't say how long it takes someone. But you want to be in a kitchen where you're exposed to as many influences as possible. Mm-hmm. I think, in order to build that toolkit. Mm-hmm. And it's for some people and not for others, and it's really a personal journey.
Yeah, we were personally talking before the show about your kitchen. You're a tremendous restaurant, fabulous kitchen. It's a large kitchen, and you're doing a lot of stuff there. And maybe some of the students or young chefs want to work in smaller kitchens. But right. There's something to be said about obtaining the toolkit in a kitchen like yours. And, you know, could you elaborate?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, when I put my proposal together for Porterhouse New York is an American steakhouse. But we hark back to the traditional steakhouse, and we also have modern. We also have a modern feel for what we do, and we have a big menu. It's not just about steak. It's also about. It's not just about beef. It's also about seafood and fish and lobsters. It's also about great poultry that we were talking about, and it's also about outstanding produce, vegetables. You know, that make up the menu. So there are limitations in any model, but in a kitchen like that I have at Porterhouse, there's actually we cook a lot of we have a great range, and I think it's that range. You know, we're speaking to an audience, and we're there for our guests. Mm-hmm. You know, it is about, you know, how to offer them what we do, make it unique and different from other steakhouses, other places, and we have we have prime beef. But we use natural hormone-free beef, naturally raised, no hormones, no antibiotics, but it is prime beef. And, you know, we are purchasing, and the actual ingredients are key to what we do. We really try to find the very best in meat, fish, poultry, produce, whatever that it is that goes on our menu. It's important that it be of really the highest quality. And that maybe sets us apart from other steakhouses. Not saying that, it's just that the determination we have. But we also have a big menu, so it's a lot to fulfill every day.
It's the perfect steakhouse if you have a lot of people, or even just two of you, and one person loves steak and the other doesn't, because you're equally brilliant with working with both. You know, fish, fowl.
Thank you. No, but it's
a steakhouse, but it's not.
It makes
you know,
us
in
happy,
that sense,
right?
You know, it's a real restaurant where you can get. Anyway,
well,
we're gonna
American Grill. I think that's it. That's it.
It's an American Grill.
That's what we do.
That happens to have fabulous steaks.
That's all.
Yeah. Okay, we're gonna take another break here, and we're gonna come back and go on your journey.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And today we're at Roberta's in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And my guest...
Bushwick. I'm from Bensonhurst.
Oh, sorry. I got that mixed up. Oh, my God. At least I didn't say Marine Park.
No, it's my fault. It's my fault.
We both lived at one point. But today my guest is that Brooklynite chef... Michael LaMonaco of Porterhouse, New York, and we are on his chef's journey. And, you know, let's pick up. You've just been the chef at the 21 Club, and What happened after the 21 Club?
Yeah, seven.
That was
seven
the first
years.
Time you were an executive chef,
right? And that was, you know, that was 7 years, and I had spent 2 years there before. You know, that was a transformative experience because at 21, it was really where I embraced the American modern American cooking. Now, maybe it's a trite name, modern American cooking. What is that? Well, partly it had to do with great ingredients. Partly it had to do with finding your own creative center. Mm-hmm. And I think, and also reinterpreting classics. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did within the confines of 21's, you know, setup. It was, it's a classic restaurant that's been there since the heyday of Prohibition. Mm-hmm. So from there, really, I set off to do two things. One was television in the early days of Food Network.
Right.
And I had Michael's Place starting in 1996 on Food Network for 3 years. Michael's Place was it was my show to, you know, cook and teach. And, you know, I enjoyed the communication aspect of getting people, you know, excited about cooking and also people embracing that they could do this too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what can we do together with cooking? And, you know, skillful demonstration of cooking techniques always, I think, will have a place. It may not be the most current thing on television now, but it'll come back. People will want to see technique again. Mm-hmm. They do want to see it in other places. They'll want to see, you know, what technique was. So that was that's what I did then. But also, a year later in 1997, I accepted a position at the Windows on the World, where I became the chef director. Chef director. That was Joe Baum who gave me that title because he hated the word executive chef. In fact, at Porterhouse, I'm the chef partner because it's my restaurant with my partners who are the backers and developers. And but so my title is chef partner, whatever that means. But Joe Baum hated titles.
Hopefully, it means you own the restaurant.
Right, exactly. Or you're responsible for paying all the bills.
Yes, right.
That's what it's about. But Joe Baum, who was one of the legendary restaurateurs, opened 300 restaurants in his day, including Windows on the World. That was
tell us about Windows and what the culture was.
So when Joe hired me and his partner David Emile, when they hired me, it was to be the chef director of Windows on the World restaurant, the greatest bar on earth, the whole operation.
And, for our listeners out here, that was the restaurant at the World Trade Center.
Yes,
I should say that.
And you know, that was a legendary restaurant for being at the World Trade Center. And Joe's vision in the early days was that it would be the epitome of American dining. And that was in 1976 when he opened. In 1976, the original restaurant. Mm-hmm. So I, in 1997, became the chef director of the culinary director of those restaurants.
There were a lot of rooms up there. You had Cellar in the Sky.
Right.
You had-
and we took Cellar in the Sky and turned it into something else. Which Joe embraced. We turned it into Wild Blue. And Wild Blue was a chop house, and it was 50 seats. So in a way, it set me on the road to Porterhouse, New York, years later.
So you should explain that the restaurant was on the top of the building, and everybody wanted a window seat. And nobody wanted to sit in the middle.
That's right.
So they made this little... To explain
Well, Joe was a genius because the original Windows on the World was just as you described. Everybody wanted a window seat, and he created a small cellar
intimate.
In the sky that had no windows.
Yes,
that had no windows. It was in the middle, and he surrounded it with a wine cellar, and he put in music and a live guitar playing classical music, and it was a prefix menu, and it was all wine and food pairing, which in 1976 was a novel idea in an American restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And but in 1997 we, you know, it had all been revitalized, and I was. The culinary director until the end. It was an incredible experience.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great staff, and we lost many, many dear people on that day. Many, many really important, wonderful colleagues and friends. And it was a devastating experience for everybody and for the city and for the nation.
And for the nation. And the story is that you were downstairs having your glasses fixed.
I was most fortunate. I had not gone up to my office yet that morning. But, you know, in the aftermath, we created Windows of Hope Family Relief Fund. We raised $22 million the families of food service workers who had lost somebody that day. And we were able to use those funds for health care and emergency needs. And it has been as a scholarship fund for the last eight or nine years.
Children.
Yeah. So there are still funds that are set aside as a scholarship fund for about 150 children who lost a parent on that day. So, you know, this was something that had to be done.
So let me ask you something. After you go through something like that, How do you reset yourself?
Well, this is my city. This is where I live and work. So more than anything, I rededicated myself not only to what I do for me, but to do what my friends and colleagues were doing on that day. Working in a restaurant, serving the public. Working as, you know, working in hospitality. Hospitality, some people don't like the word hospitality. Hospitality is making people feel welcome and doing for them the things that they would like done for them. That makes that hospitality was what my colleagues and friends were doing on that day. So what I rededicated myself to was working in the industry to which they had dedicated their lives. I dedicate my life and continue to do that in their memory every day. So it is part of my morning ritual. It is part of my daily ritual to consciously, you know, make that effort that this is another day that I could be here to dedicate myself to the memory of my friends.
That's extraordinary.
It's true.
It's extraordinary.
So, you know, Porterhouse, New York, we opened in 2006. I continued to do television. I did a lot
Between 2001, you had five years there. So you
did a lot
Michael's
of television. Right. Well, I know I did Epicurious on the Travel Channel for 7 years until from 97 until 2006. I was doing Epicurious. So that was cooking and traveling. A lot of food and food travel show is what it was.
Did you miss being a chef in a kitchen?
I was doing so much consulting. I did a cookbook in that period. I was really doing...
The cookbook's name is... All right, next. Okay, we'll remember Cooking with Michael LaMonaco.
No, wait. Let's go back.
Would somebody go to Amazon right now and tell us the author is Michael LaMonaco? All right.
You know, the most important thing was really to keep working, and working was cooking, was teaching, you know, I never stopped, but certainly to find a place in New York was really my goal, to find a place to be my home. A place that would be, you know, really my home and my home base. And, you know, the opportunity to do that at the Time Warner Center really came up in 2006. And I jumped at it because it's a great location overlooking the park. And really to build an American grill that was casual and comfortable, you know, really to do that was really something that I had really worked for really many years.
Well, the Time Warner building is sort of the iconic location for restaurants in New York. Your neighbors there are Per Se and Massa and Avoce. So you're in the big time there. You're
exactly
the top of the pyramid. You couldn't have done better.
You know, so the book Nightly Specials was the book that we were talking about a second ago, Nightly Specials.
Jack Inslee, our producer, ran in here with this, and he didn't see it. Thank God.
I didn't know I'd get a chance to plug a book. But Nightly Specials was really about cooking, you know, really about cooking the nightly specials in restaurants and sort of the creative process. And, you know, the casual dining world has grown, and that's really what dining is about. Not formal, not stuffy, but casual and relaxed. So Porterhouse, New York, was my idea of how to take what might have been a little stuffy, the classic steakhouse, make it casual and comfortable in a great iconic location. So we're in a restaurant collection, as you mentioned, Per Se and Massa and Avoce and Stone Rose. And now we have a new place that I opened a few months ago on the same floor in the Time Warner Center called Center Bar. And Center Bar is a lounge where we're making really great cocktails.
Wait a minute. Does it have any windows?
It has a beautiful atrium window.
Okay, so it is in center. It is in
center bar overlooks the Columbus Circle and Central Park, and we have.
Didn't you just get a great review in the Post today?
In the Post, it's a piano bar.
Today, go get it.
We have jazz piano playing five nights a week. I love music, so incorporating music was a big part of it, and it's all small plates of different food, different than Porterhouse. So it's a new creative outlet. So that's always exciting. It opens at 4 p.m.
Oh, four. That's
and it opens at 1 o'clock on Saturdays and Sundays, so we get a little bit of afternoon on and the weekends. But
how many seats?
50.
Oh, that's a nice.
So it's small. It's intimate. It's very comfortable. But for me, it's another outlet. So we're doing a whole new range of dishes, and they're small plates. What does that mean? They're not big portions. You know, steaks are big.
Yes.
But something different, and that's not only for me, but for my team. Mm-hmm. It's great to have this additional outlet, and it's also paired with really a wonderful cocktail program that James Moreland and Brad Nugent, my two beverage guys, have put together. And it was also about having an encyclopedic approach to cocktails, not only our house cocktails, our own signature ones, but we really do a very broad range of classic cocktails.
What's your favorite classic cocktail?
For me personally to drink, we make a drink actually that we call a King's Old Fashioned. That's one of my favorites. But my true favorite is a Manhattan. I really
am. Mine too.
I'm a Manhattan.
What whiskey do you put in it?
I like rye.
I do. And what kind of rye?
And, you know,
I'm a Michter's fan.
Well, there are some great ryes. And in fact, there's a rye. There's a New York rye that you can get now.
I heard. I haven't
some,
had that
You know,
yet.
I like rye. And you know why? Because I remember rye even from my childhood. Not that I was drinking it, but I remember the adults liked rye.
I remember a song, Rye Whiskey, Rye
That's right.
Whiskey, Rye Whiskey, exactly. Rye.
And they
I
used
don't
to,
have my rye whiskey,
used to
I
have
think I'll die.
Rockin' Rye, which had rock crystal sugar hanging in the bottle, so you always got an old thing that I remember. But I like history, and I think that in cooking, you have to have a sense of where you're going, and you have to have a sense of modernity and moving ahead. But I also enjoy looking back and paying tribute to those who came before. And that's why I like to go to
Michael,
Italy.
Michael, we have to do another show.
Okay.
I mean, we've run out of time, but will you promise me when the weather gets warmer, how about we take my portable show and we go out and we do Brooklyn together?
Oh, yeah.
We'll visit like five or six of our local haunts. We'll go to Sheepshead Bay.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
My brother showed me a place with, oh, my God, mozzarella. They give it to you warm in your hand,
yes.
And you go, oh, my God. So it's known. Okay. So, Michael,
thanks so much for having me.
All right. And we'll see you next time. Shout out to Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee, our producers. And see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.